only reason we listen to you today is because you're just as bad at being open as we are. If you didn't wrestle with being vulnerable, we wouldn't trust you one bit. Not only did I believe him, but I totally agreed. I trust the strategies that I'm writing about here for two reasons. First, the research participants who shared them with me had wrestled with the same gremlins, discomfort, and self-doubt that we all face. Second, I've practiced these strategies in my own life, and I know for a fact that they're not just game changers, they're lifesavers. The three forms of shielding that I'm about to introduce are what I refer to as the common vulnerability arsenal, because I've found that we all incorporate them into our personal armor in some way. These include foreboding joy, perfectionism, and numbing. Each shield is followed by daring greatly strategies, all variants on being enough, that prove to be effective at disarming the three common forms of shielding. The common vulnerability shields. The shield, foreboding joy. Given that I study emotions like fear, shame, and vulnerability, I hardly expected to one day be telling you that exploring the construct of joy turned my professional and personal life upside down. But it's true. In fact, having spent several years studying what it means to be joyful, I'd argue that joy is probably the most difficult emotion to really feel. Why? Because when we lose the ability or willingness to be vulnerable, joy becomes something we approach with deep foreboding. This shift from our younger selves' greeting of joy with unalloyed delight happens slowly and outside of our awareness. We don't seem to even know that it's happening or why. We just know that we crave more joy in our lives, that we are joy-starved. In a culture of deep scarcity, of never feeling safe, certain, and sure enough, joy can feel like a setup. We wake up in the morning and think, work is going well, everyone in the family is healthy, no major crises are happening, the house is still standing, I'm working out, feeling good. Oh shit, this is bad. This is really bad. Disaster must be lurking right around the corner. Or we get promoted and our first thought is, too good to be true, what's the catch? We find out we're pregnant and we think, our daughter's really healthy and happy, so something really bad is going to happen with this baby, I just know it. We're taking our first family vacation, but rather than being excited, we're making plans for the plane to go down or the ship to sink. We're always waiting for the other shoe to drop. That expression originated in the early 1900s when new immigrants and people flooding to the cities were crammed into tenement housing where you'd literally hear your upstairs neighbor taking off his shoes at night. Once you heard the first shoe hit the floor, you waited for the other shoe to drop. Even though the world today is much safer in many ways than it was in the early part of that century, and our life expectancy is far greater than the folks who were listening for a second shoe to hit the floor, the stakes feel so much higher to us. Most of us today think about the other shoe as something terrifying. A terrorist attack, a natural disaster, an E. coli outbreak in our local grocery store, a school shooting. When I started asking participants about the experiences that left them feeling the most vulnerable, I didn't expect joy to be one of the answers. I expected fear and shame, but not the joyful moments of our lives. I asked people when they felt their most vulnerable. I was shocked to hear these answers. Standing over my children while they're sleeping. Acknowledging how much I love my partner. Knowing how good I've got it. Loving my job. Spending time with my parents. Watching my parents play with my children. Thinking about my relationship with my boyfriend. Getting engaged. Going into remission. Having a baby. Getting promoted. Being happy. Falling in love. Not only was I shocked to hear these answers, I knew I was personally in trouble. Before my 2007 breakdown spiritual awakening, foreboding joy was one of my own unconscious pieces of armor. When I first made the connection between vulnerability and joy, reported by participants, I could barely breathe. I had considered my constant disaster planning as my little secret. I was convinced that I was the only one who stood over my children while they slept, and in the split second that I had become engulfed with love and adoration, pictured something really terrible happening to them. I was sure that no one but me pictured car wrecks and rehearsed the horrific phone conversations with the police that all of us dread. One of the first stories I heard was from a woman in her late 40s. "I used to take every good thing and imagine the worst possible disaster," she told me. "I would literally picture the worst-case scenario and try to control all of the outcomes. When my daughter got into the college of her dreams, I just knew something bad would happen if she moved too far away. I spent the entire summer before she left trying to convince her to go to a local school. It crushed her confidence and took the fun out of our last summer. It was a painful lesson. Now I cross my fingers, stay grateful, pray, and try like hell to push the bad images out of my head. Unfortunately, I've passed that way of thinking down to my daughter. She's increasingly afraid to try new things, especially when her life is going well. She tells me that she doesn't want to tempt fate." A man in his early 60s told me, "I used to think the best way to go through life was to expect the worst. That way, if it happened, you were prepared. And if it didn't happen, you were pleasantly surprised. Then I was in a car accident and my wife was killed. Needless to say, expecting the worst didn't prepare me at all. And worse, I still grieve for all of those wonderful moments we shared that I didn't fully enjoy. My commitment to her is to fully enjoy every moment now. I just wish she was here now that I know how to do that." These stories illustrate how the concept of foreboding joy as a method of minimizing vulnerability is best understood as a continuum that runs from rehearsing tragedy to what I call perpetual disappointment. Some of us, like the woman in the first story, scramble to the bleakest, worst-case scenario when joy rears its vulnerable head, while others never even see joy, preferring to stay in an unmoving state of perpetual disappointment. What the perpetual disappointment folks described is this: it's easier to live disappointed than it is to feel disappointed. It feels more vulnerable to dip in and out of disappointment than to just set up camp there. You sacrifice joy, but you suffer less pain. Both of these ends of the continuum tell the same story. Softening into the joyful moments of our lives requires vulnerability. If, like me, you've ever stood over your children and thought to yourself, "I love you so much I can barely breathe," and in that exact moment have been flooded with images of something terrible happening to your child, know that you are not crazy, nor are you alone. About 90% of the parents I've interviewed acknowledged having that experience. The same percentage holds true for the thousands of parents I've spoken to and worked with over the years. Why? What are we doing and why on earth are we doing it? Once we make the connection between vulnerability and joy, the answer is pretty straightforward. We're trying to beat vulnerability to the punch. We don't want to be blindsided by hurt. We don't want to be caught off guard, so we literally practice being devastated or never move from self-elected disappointment. For those of us who rehearse tragedy, there's a reason those images flood into our mind the second we're overwhelmed with joy. When we spend our lives knowingly or unknowingly pushing away vulnerability, we can't hold space open for the uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure of joy. For many of us, there's even a physiological response, a coming out of our skin feeling. We're desperate for more joy, but at the same time, we can't tolerate the vulnerability. And our culture assists in this doom-filled rehearsal. Most of us have a stockpile of terrible images that we can pull from the instant we're grappling with vulnerability. I often ask audience members to raise their hands if they've seen a graphically violent image in the past week. About 20% of the audience normally raises their hands. Then I reframe the question. Raise your hand if you've watched the news, CSI, NCIS, Law & Order, Bones, or any other crime show on TV. At that point, about 80 to 90% of the audience hands go up. We have the images we need to activate foreboding joy right at our neurological fingertips. We're visual people. We trust, consume, and mentally store what we see. I remember recently being in the car with Steve and the kids as we were headed to San Antonio for a long weekend. Charlie was performing his new knock-knock joke routine for us, and we were all cracking up, even his older sister. I started welling up with joy. And in that very split second that vulnerability hit me, I shuddered, recalling an image from the news that showed an overturned SUV on I-10 and two empty car seats lying on the ground next to the truck. My laughter turned to panic, and I remember blurting out, "Slow down, Steve." He looked at me with a puzzled expression and said, "We're stopped." Daring greatly, practicing gratitude. Even those of us who have learned to lean into joy and embrace our experiences are not immune to the uncomfortable quake of vulnerability that often accompanies joyful moments. We've just learned how to use it as a reminder rather than a warning shot. What was the most surprising and life-changing difference for me was the nature of that reminder. For those welcoming the experience, the shudder of vulnerability that accompanies joy is an invitation to practice gratitude, to acknowledge how truly grateful we are for the person, the beauty, the connection, or simply the moment before us. Gratitude, emerged from the data, is the antidote to foreboding joy. In fact, every participant who spoke about the ability to stay open to joy also talked about the importance of practicing gratitude. This pattern of association was so thoroughly prevalent in the data that I made a commitment as a researcher not to talk about joy without talking about gratitude. It wasn't just the relationship between joy and gratitude that took me by surprise. I was also startled by the fact that research participants consistently described both joyfulness and gratitude as spiritual practices that were bound to a belief in human connectiveness and a power greater than us. Their stories and descriptions expanded on this, pointing to a clear distinction between happiness and joy. Participants described happiness as an emotion that's connected to circumstances, and they described joy as a spiritual way of engaging with the world that's connected to practicing gratitude. While I was initially taken aback by the relationship between joy and vulnerability, it now makes perfect sense to me, and I can see why gratitude would be the antidote to foreboding joy. Scarcity and fear drive foreboding joy. We're afraid that the feeling of joy won't last, or there won't be enough, or that the transition to disappointment, or whatever is in store for us next, will be too difficult. We've learned that giving in to joy is, at best, setting ourselves up for disappointment, and at worst, inviting disaster. And we struggle with the worthiness issue. Do we deserve our joy, given our inadequacies and imperfections? What about the starving children and the war-ravaged world? Who are we to be joyful? If the opposite of scarcity is enough, then practicing gratitude is how we acknowledge that there's enough and that we're enough. I use the word practicing because the research participants spoke of tangible gratitude practices, more than merely having an attitude of gratitude or feeling grateful. In fact, they gave specific examples of gratitude practices that included everything from keeping journals and gratitude jars to implementing family gratitude rituals. Actually, I learned the most about gratitude practices from the people who had experienced some of the most profound losses or survived the greatest traumas. These included parents whose children had died, family members with terminally ill loved ones, and genocide and trauma survivors. One of the questions I'm most often asked is, "Don't you get really depressed talking to people about vulnerability and hearing about people's darkest struggles?" My answer is no, never. That's because I've learned more about worthiness, resilience, and joy from these people who courageously shared their struggles with me than from any other part of my work. And nothing's been a greater gift to me than the three lessons I learned about joy and light from people who've spent time in sorrow and darkness. Number one, joy comes to us in moments, ordinary moments. We risk missing out on joy when we get too busy chasing down the extraordinary. Scarcity culture may keep us afraid of living small, ordinary lives, but when you talk to people who have survived great losses, it is clear that joy is not a constant. Without exception, all participants who spoke to me about their losses and what they missed the most spoke about ordinary moments. For example, if I could come downstairs and see my husband sitting at the table and cursing at the newspaper, if I could hear my son giggling in the backyard. My mom used to send me the craziest texts. She never knew how to work her phone. I'd give anything to get one of those texts right now. Number two, be grateful for what you have. When I asked people who had survived tragedy how we can cultivate and show more compassion for people who are suffering, The answer was always the same. Don't shrink away from the joy of your child, because I've lost mine. Don't take what you have for granted. Celebrate it. Don't apologize for what you have. Be grateful for it and share your gratitude with others. Are your parents healthy? Be thrilled. Let them know how much they mean to you. The underlying sentiment from these research participants was breathtaking. When you honor what you have, you're honoring what I've lost. Last, number three, don't squander joy. We can't prepare for every tragedy and loss. When we turn every opportunity to feel joy into a test drive for despair, we actually diminish our resilience. Yes, softening into joy is uncomfortable. Yes, it's scary. Yeah, it's vulnerable. But every time we allow ourselves to lean into joy and give into those moments, we build resilience and we cultivate hope. The joy becomes part of who we are, and when bad things happen, and they do happen, we are stronger. It took me a couple of years to understand and integrate this information and to start to cultivate a gratitude practice. Ellen, on the other hand, seemed to intuitively understand the importance of acknowledging and owning joy. When she was in the first grade, we played hooky one afternoon and spent the day at the park. At one point, we were on the paddle boat. We were feeding ducks stale bread that we had brought from home. And I realized that she had stopped pedaling and was sitting perfectly still in her seat. Her hands were wrapped around the bread sack, her head was tilted back, and her eyes were closed. The sun was shining on her uplifted face, and she had a quiet smile on her face. I was so struck by her beauty and her vulnerability that I could barely catch my breath. I watched for a full minute, but when she didn't move, I got a little nervous. Ellie? Is everything okay, sweetie? Her smile widened and she opened her eyes. She looked at me and said, I'm fine, Mama. I was just making a picture memory. I had never heard of a picture memory, but I liked the sound of it. What does that mean? Oh, a picture memory is a picture I take in my mind when I'm really, really happy. I close my eyes and I take a picture so when I'm feeling sad or scared or lonely, I can look at my picture memories. I'm not as eloquent or poised as my then 6-year-old daughter, but I've been practicing. For me, expressing gratitude is still bumpier than it is graceful or fluid. I still get overwhelmed with vulnerability in the midst of joyful experiences. But now I've learned to literally say aloud, I'm feeling vulnerable and I'm so grateful for. Now, this can be fairly awkward in the middle of a conversation, but it's much better than the alternative, catastrophizing and controlling. Just recently, Steve told me that he was thinking about taking the kids to his family's farmhouse in Pennsylvania while I was out of town for work. I immediately thought it was a great idea, until I started boarding the crazy train of, oh my God, I can't let them fly without me. What if something happens? Rather than picking a fight, being critical, or making up something to quash the idea without revealing my unreasonable fears, for example, that's a terrible idea, airfare is really high right now, or that's selfish, I want to go too, I just said, vulnerability, vulnerability, vulnerability. I'm grateful for the kids getting to spend alone time with you and explore the country outside. Steve smiled. He's well aware of my practice and he knew I meant it. Before I put this research on countering foreboding joy into practice, I never knew how to get past that immediate shudder of vulnerability. I didn't have the information to get from my fears to how I actually felt, to what I really wanted in my life. Gratitude fueled joy. Let's go to the second shield, perfectionism. One of my favorite features on my blog is my Daring Interview series. It's special to me because I only interview people whom I find truly inspirational. People who engage with the world in a way that inspires me to be more creative and a little bit braver with my own work. I've always asked interviewees the same group of questions, and after the wholehearted research emerged, I started asking questions about vulnerability and perfectionism. As a recovering perfectionist and an inspiring good enoughist, I'm always finding myself skimming down the list of questions we ask in these interviews to read the answer to this question first. Is perfectionism an issue for you? If so, what's one of your strategies for managing it? I ask this question because in all my data collecting, I've never heard one person attribute their joy, success, or wholeheartedness to being perfect. In fact, what I've heard over and over throughout the years is one clear message. The most valuable and important things in my life came to me when I cultivated the courage to become vulnerable, imperfect, and self-compassionate. Perfectionism is not the path that leads us to our gifts or to our sense of purpose. It's the detour. I'm going to share a few of my favorite answers from the interviews with you, but first I want to tell you about the definition of perfectionism that bubbled up from the data. Here's what I learned. Like vulnerability, perfectionism is shrouded by mythology. I think it's helpful to start by looking at what perfectionism isn't. Perfectionism is not the same thing as striving for excellence. Perfectionism is not healthy achievement or growth. Perfectionism is a defense move. It's the belief that if we do things perfectly and look perfect, we can minimize or avoid the pain of blame, judgment, and shame. Perfectionism is a 20-ton shield that we lug around thinking it will protect us, when in fact, it's the thing that really prevents us from being seen. Perfectionism is also not self-improvement. Perfectionism is, at its core, about trying to earn approval. Most perfectionists grew up being praised for achievement and performance. Grades, manners, rule-following, people-pleasing, appearance, sports. Somewhere along the way, they adopted this dangerous and debilitating belief system. I am what I accomplish and how well I accomplish it. Please perform perfect. Healthy striving is self-focused. How can I improve? Perfectionism is other-focused. What will people think? Perfectionism is a hustle. Perfectionism is also not the key to success. In fact, research shows that perfectionism hampers achievement. Perfectionism is correlated with depression, anxiety, addiction, life paralysis, and missed opportunities. The fear of failing, making mistakes, not meeting people's expectations, and being criticized keeps us outside of the arena where healthy competition and striving unfolds. Last, perfectionism is not a way to avoid shame. Perfectionism is a form of shame. Where we struggle with perfectionism, we struggle with shame. After using the data to bushwhack my way through the myths, I then developed the following definition of perfectionism. Perfectionism is a self-destructive and addictive belief system that fuels this primary thought. If I look perfect and do everything perfectly, I can avoid or minimize the painful feelings of shame, judgment, and blame. Perfectionism is self-destructive simply because perfection doesn't exist. It's not attainable. Perfectionism is more about perception than internal motivation, and there's no way to control perception, no matter how much time and energy we spend trying. Perfectionism is addictive because when we invariably do experience shame, judgment, and blame, we often believe it's because we weren't perfect enough. Rather than questioning the faulty logic of perfectionism, we become even more entrenched in our quest to look and do everything perfect. Perfectionism actually sets us up to feel shame, judgment, and blame, which then leads to even more shame and self-blame. It's my fault. I'm feeling this way because I'm not good enough. So what is the Daring Greatly solution? Appreciate the beauty of cracks. Just as our experiences of foreboding joy can be located on a continuum, I found that most of us fall somewhere on a perfectionism continuum. In other words, when it comes to hiding our flaws, managing perception, and wanting to win over folks, we're all hustling a little. For some folks, perfectionism may only emerge when they're feeling particularly vulnerable. For others, perfectionism is compulsive, chronic, and debilitating. It actually looks and feels like an addiction. Regardless of where we are on this continuum, if we want freedom from perfectionism, we have to make the long journey from what will people think to I am enough. That journey begins with shame resilience, self-compassion, and owning our stories. To claim the truths about who we are, where we come from, what we believe, and the very imperfect nature of our lives, we have to be willing to give ourselves a break and to appreciate the beauty of our cracks, our imperfections. To be kinder and gentler with ourselves and each other. To talk to ourselves the same way we talk to someone we care about. Dr. Kristen Neff, a researcher and professor at the University of Texas at Austin, runs the Self-Compassion Research Lab, where she studies how we develop and practice self-compassion. According to Neff, self-compassion has three elements: self-kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. In her new book, Self-Compassion, Stop Beating Yourself Up and Leave Insecurity Behind, She defines each of these elements. Self-kindness is being warm and understanding toward ourselves when we suffer, fail, or feel inadequate, rather than ignoring our pain or flagellating ourselves with self-criticism. Common humanity is about recognizing that suffering and feelings of personal inadequacy are part of the shared human experience, something we all go through rather than something that happens to just me alone. And last, mindfulness. This is about taking a balanced approach to negative emotions so that feelings are neither suppressed nor exaggerated. We cannot ignore our pain and feel compassion for it at the same time. Mindfulness requires that we not over-identify with thoughts and feelings so that we're caught up and swept away by the negativity either. I love how her definition of mindfulness reminds us that being mindful also means not over-identifying or exaggerating our feelings. For me, it's so easy to get stuck in regret or shame or self-criticism when I make a mistake. But self-compassion requires an observant and accurate perspective when feeling shame or pain. Dr. Neff has a great website where you can take a self-compassion inventory and learn more about her research. The web address is www.self-compassion.org. In addition to practicing self-compassion, and trust me, like gratitude and everything else worthwhile, it is a practice. We must also remember that our worthiness, that core belief that we're enough, comes only when we live inside our story. We either own our stories, even the really messy ones, or we stand outside of them, denying our vulnerabilities and imperfection, orphaning the parts of us that don't fit in with who or what we think we're supposed to be, and we hustle for other people's approval of our worthiness. Perfectionism is exhausting because hustling is exhausting. It's a never-ending performance. I want to go back now to the Daring interview series from my blog and share some of the responses with you. In these responses, I see the beauty of being real, of embracing the cracks, and I'm inspired by the self-compassion. I think they'll inspire you too. The first is from Gretchen Rubin, the best-selling writer whose book The Happiness Project is the account of the year she spent test driving studies and theories about how to be happier. Here's how she answered the question about managing perfectionism. I remind myself, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. She says that was cribbed from Voltaire. She goes on, a 20-minute walk that I do is better than a 4-mile run that I don't do. The imperfect book that gets published is better than the perfect book that never leaves my computer. The dinner party of takeout Chinese food is better than the elegant dinner that I never host. Andrea Shear is a photographer, writer, and life coach living in Berkeley, California. She inspires others to live authentic, colorful, and creative lives. About perfectionism, she writes, I was a competitive gymnast as a kid, got perfect attendance every year in school, was terrified of getting anything worse than an A-, and had an eating disorder in high school. Oh, and I think I was the homecoming queen. Yep, I think I have some issues with perfectionism. But I've been working on it. As a kid, I equated being perfect with being loved. And I think I still confuse the two. I often find myself doing what Brené calls the hustle for worthiness. That dance we do so that people don't see how incredibly flawed and human we are. Sometimes I have my self-worth wrapped up in what I do and how good I look doing it. But mostly I'm learning to let go. Parenthood has taught me a lot about that. It's messy and humbling, and I'm learning to show my mess. To manage my perfectionism, I give myself tons of permission to do things that are good enough. I do things quickly. Having small children will teach you how to do most tasks at lightning speed. And if it's good enough, it gets my stamp of approval. I have a few mantras that also help. Quick and dirty wins the race. Perfectionism is the enemy of done. Good enough is really effing good. Nicholas Wilton is the artist behind the beautiful illustrations on some of my earlier book covers. In addition to showing his gallery exhibitions and inclusion in private collections, he's the founder of the Art Plane Method, a system of fundamental painting and intuition principles that help enable the creative process. I absolutely love what he writes about perfectionism and art. It completely aligns with the research finding that perfectionism crushes creativity, which is why one of the most effective ways to start recovering from perfectionism is to start creating. Here's what Nick has to say. I always felt that someone, a long time ago, organized the affairs of the world into areas that made sense. Categories of stuff that is perfectible. Things that fit neatly in perfect bundles. The world of business, for example, is this way. Line items, spreadsheets, things that add up, that can be perfected. The legal system, not always perfect, but nonetheless a mind-numbing effort to actually write down all kinds of laws and instructions that cover all aspects of being human. A kind of umbrella code of conduct we should all follow. Perfectionism is crucial in building an aircraft, a bridge, or a high-speed train. The code and mathematics residing just below the surface of the internet is also this way. Things are either perfectly right or they don't work. So much of the world we work and live in is based upon being correct, being perfect. But after this someone got through organizing everything just perfectly, he, or probably a she, was left with a bunch of stuff that didn't fit anywhere. Things in a shoebox that had to go somewhere. So in desperation, this person threw up her arms and said, okay, fine. All the rest of this stuff that isn't perfectible, that doesn't seem to fit anywhere else, will just have to be piled into this last, rather large, tattered box that we can sort of push behind the couch. Maybe later we can come back and figure out where it all is supposed to fit in. Let's label the box art. The problem was thankfully never fixed, and in time the box overflowed as more and more art piled up. I think the dilemma exists because art, among all the other tidy categories, most closely resembles what it's like to be human, to be alive. It is our nature to be imperfect, to have uncategorized feelings and emotions, to make or do things that don't sometimes necessarily make sense. Art is all just perfectly imperfect. Once the word art enters the description of what you're up to, it's almost like getting a hall pass from perfection. It thankfully releases us from any expectation of perfection. In relation to my own work, not being perfect, I just always point to the tattered box behind the couch and mention the word art, and people seem to understand and let you off the hook about being perfect and go back to their business. And there's a quote that I share every time I talk about vulnerability and perfectionism. My fixation with these words from Leonard Cohen's song Anthem comes from how much comfort and hope they give me as I put enough into practice. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. The shield numbing. If you're wondering if this section is about addiction and you're thinking, this isn't about me, please keep listening. This is about all of us. First, one of the most universal numbing strategies is what I call crazy busy. I often say that when they start having 12-step meetings for busyaholics, they'll need to rent out football stadiums. We are a culture of people who've bought into the idea that if we stay busy enough, the truth of our lives won't catch up with us. Second, statistics dictate that there are very few people who haven't been affected by addiction. I believe we all numb our feelings. We may not do so compulsively and chronically, which is addiction, but that doesn't mean that we don't numb our sense of vulnerability. And numbing vulnerability is especially debilitating because it doesn't just deaden the pain of our difficult experiences. Numbing vulnerability also dulls our experiences of love, joy, belonging, creativity, and empathy. We can't selectively numb emotion. Numb the dark and you numb the light. If you're also wondering if numbing refers to doing illegal drugs or having a few glasses of wine after work, the answer is yes. I'm going to argue that we need to examine the idea of taking the edge off. And that means considering the glasses of wine we drink while we're cooking dinner, eating dinner, cleaning up after dinner, our 60-hour work weeks, the sugar, the fantasy football, the prescription pills, the 4 shots of espresso that we drink in order to clear the fog from the wine, and the Advil PM. I'm talking about you and me and the stuff we do every day. When I looked at the data, my primary question was, what are we numbing and why? Americans today are more in debt, obese, medicated, and addicted than we have ever been. For the first time in history, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, has announced that automobile accidents are now the second leading cause of accidental death in the U.S. The leading cause? Drug overdoses. In fact, more people die from prescription drug overdoses than from heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine drug use combined. Even more alarming is the estimate that less than 5% of those who died from prescription drug overdoses obtained their drugs from folks we normally think of as street corner drug dealers. The dealers today are more likely to be parents, relatives, friends, and physicians. Clearly, there's a problem. We're desperate to feel less or more of something, to make something go away, or to have more of something else. Having spent years working closely with addiction researchers and clinicians, I had guessed that the primary driver of numbing would be our struggles with worthiness and shame. We numb the pain that comes from feeling inadequate and less than. But that was only part of the puzzle. Anxiety and disconnection also emerged as drivers of numbing in addition to shame. As I'll explain, the most powerful need for numbing seems to come from the combinations of all three, shame, anxiety, and disconnection. The anxiety described by research participants appeared to be fueled by uncertainty, overwhelming and competing demands on our time, and, one of the big surprises, social discomfort. Disconnection was tougher to nail down. I thought about using the term depression rather than disconnection, but as I recoded the data, that's not what I heard. I instead heard a range of experiences that encompassed depression, but also included loneliness, isolation, disengagement, and emptiness. Again, what was really powerful for me, personally and professionally, was seeing the strong pattern of shame threading through the experiences of anxiety and our disconnection. The most accurate answers to the questions about what drives numbing sound more like the answers to, what's your sign? Anxiety with shame rising. Disconnection with shame rising. Anxiety and disconnection with shame rising. Shame enters for those of us who experience anxiety because not only are we feeling fearful, out of control, and incapable of managing our increasingly demanding lives, but eventually our anxiety is compounded and made unbearable by our belief that if we were just smarter, stronger, or better, we'd be able to handle everything. Numbing here becomes a way to take the edge off both instability and inadequacy. With disconnection, it's a similar story. We may have a couple hundred friends on Facebook, plus a slew of colleagues, real-life friends, and neighbors, but we feel alone and unseen. Because we are hardwired for connection, disconnection always creates pain. Feeling disconnected can be a normal part of life and relationships. But when coupled with the shame of believing that we're disconnected because we're not worthy of connection, it creates a pain that we want to numb. One stop beyond disconnection is isolation, which presents real danger. Jean Baker Miller and Irene Stiver, relational cultural theorists from the Stone Center at Wellesley College, have eloquently captured the extremity of isolation. They write, "We believe that the most terrifying and destructive feeling that a person can experience is psychological isolation. This is not the same as being alone. It is a feeling that one is locked out of the possibility of human connection and of being powerless to change the situation. In the extreme, psychological isolation can lead to a sense of hopelessness and desperation. People will do almost anything to escape this combination of condemned isolation and powerlessness." The part of this definition that is critical to understanding shame resilience is the sentence, "People will do almost anything to escape the combination of condemned isolation and powerlessness." Shame often leads to desperation, and reactions to this desperate need to escape from isolation and fear can run the gamut from numbing to addiction, depression, self-injury, eating disorders, bullying, violence, and suicide. As I thought back on my own numbing history, understanding how shame magnifies anxiety and disconnection provided me with answers to questions that I've had for years. I didn't start drinking to drown my sorrows. I just needed something to do with my hands. In fact, I'm convinced that if smartphones and the bejeweled chihuahuas that today's celebrities sport as accessories had been in fashion when I was in my late teens, I never would have started smoking and drinking. I drank and smoked to minimize my feelings of vulnerability and to look busy when all of the other girls at my table had been asked to dance. I literally needed something to do, something to help me look busy. 25 years ago, it felt as if my only choice was nursing a beer, stirring an amaretto sour, are fiddling with cigarettes. I was alone at the table with no one and nothing to keep me company except for my vices. For me, vulnerability led to anxiety, which led to shame, which led to disconnection, which led to Bud Light. For many of us, the literal chemical anesthetizing of emotions is just a pleasant, albeit dangerous, side effect of behaviors that are more about fitting in, finding connection, and managing anxiety. I quit drinking and smoking 22 years ago. In The Gifts of Imperfection, I write, I wasn't raised with the skills and emotional practice needed to lean into discomfort, so over time I basically became a take-the-edge-off-aholic. But they don't have meetings for that, and after some brief experimenting, I learned that describing your addiction that way in a traditional 12-step meeting doesn't always go over well with the purists. For me, it wasn't just the dance halls, cold beer, and Marlboro Lights of my youth that got out of hand. It was banana bread, chips and queso, email, work, staying busy, incessant worrying, planning, perfectionism, and anything else that could dull those agonizing and anxiety-fueled feelings of vulnerability. Let's look at the Daring Greatly strategies for numbing. Daring greatly means setting boundaries, finding true comfort, and cultivating spirit. When I interviewed the research participants, whom I'd describe as living a wholehearted life, about numbing, they consistently talked about three things. One, learning how to actually feel their feelings. Two, staying mindful about numbing, because they struggled too. And three, learning how to lean into the discomfort of hard emotion. This all made perfect sense to me, but I wanted to know exactly how you lean into anxiety and disconnection. So I started interviewing people about this question specifically. As I expected, there was more to it. These folks had elevated enough to whole new levels. Yes, they practiced mindfulness and leaning, but they also set serious boundaries in their lives. As I asked more pointed questions about the choices and behaviors wholehearted men and women made to reduce anxiety, they explained that reducing anxiety meant paying attention to how much they could do and how much was too much, and learning how to say enough. They got very clear on what was important to them and what they could let go of. In Sir Ken Robinson's wonderful 2010 TED Talk on the Learning Revolution, he starts to explain to the audience that he divides the world into two groups. Then he stops himself and with great humor says, Jeremy Bentham, the great utilitarian philosopher, once spiked this argument. He said, there are two types of people in the world, those who divide people into two types and those who do not. Robinson paused and smiled. Well, I do. I loved that because as a researcher, I do too. But before I talk about the two groups I identified, I want to say that this division is not exactly as neat and tidy as two discrete groups. And at the same time, it almost is. Let's take a look. When it comes to anxiety, we all struggle. Yes, there are different types of anxiety and certainly different intensities. Some anxiety is hardwired and best addressed with a combination of medication and therapy. And some of it is environmental. We're overextended and overstressed. What was interesting to me was how the participants could be divided into two camps. Group A defined the challenge of anxiety as finding ways to manage and soothe the anxiety, while Group B clearly defined the problem as changing the behaviors that led to anxiety. Participants from both groups often used today's dominating technology as an example of an anxiety-producing source during the interviews. So let's look at how these two groups thought differently about the daily onslaught of email, voicemail, and text messages. Group A. I make a pot of coffee after I tuck my kids in so I can take care of all the emails between 10 p.m. and midnight. If there are too many, I wake up at 4 a.m. and start over again. I don't like getting to work with any unanswered emails in my inbox. I'm exhausted, but they're answered. Group B. I've simply stopped sending unnecessary emails and asked my friends and colleagues to do the same. I've also started setting the expectation that it might take a few days to respond. If it's important, call me. Don't text or email. Call. Better yet, stop by my office. Group A. I use red lights, grocery lines, and elevator rides to stay on top of my calls. I even sleep with my phone in case someone calls or I remember something in the middle of the night. One time I called my assistant at 4 a.m. because I remembered that we needed to add something to a motion that we were preparing. I was surprised that she answered, but then she reminded me that I had told her to keep her phone on her nightstand. I'll rest and let steam off when we're done. Work hard, play hard. That's my motto. And it doesn't take much to play hard when you haven't slept in a while. Group B. My boss, my friends, and my family know that I don't take calls before 9 a.m. or after 9 p.m. If the phone rings after or before those times, it's either a wrong number or an emergency, a real emergency, not a work issue. The participants who struggled the most with numbing, Group A, explained that reducing anxiety meant finding ways to numb it, not changing the thinking, behaviors, or emotions that created the anxiety. I hated every minute of this part of the research. I've always looked for better ways to manage my exhaustion and anxiety. I wanted help living like this, not suggestions on how to stop living like this. My struggle mirrored the struggle that I heard from the folks who talked the most about numbing. The smaller group, Group B, the participants who addressed anxiety at the root, by aligning their lives with their values and setting boundaries, fell on the wholehearted continuum. When we asked that group about the process of setting boundaries and limits to lower the anxiety in their lives, they didn't hesitate to connect worthiness with boundaries. We have to believe we're enough in order to say enough. For women, setting boundaries is difficult because the shame gremlins are quick to weigh in. Careful saying no. You'll really disappoint these folks. Come on, don't let them down. Be a good girl, make everyone happy. For men, the gremlins whisper, man up. A real guy could take this on and then some. Is this little mama's boy just too tired today? We know that daring greatly means engaging with our vulnerability, which can't happen when shame has the upper hand. And the same is true for dealing with anxiety-fueled disconnection. The two most powerful forms of connection are love and belonging. They are both irreducible needs of all people. As I conducted my interviews, I realized that only one thing separated the men and women who felt a deep sense of love and belonging from the people who seemed to be struggling for it. That one thing was the belief in their worthiness. It's as simple and complicated as this. If we want to fully experience love and belonging, we must believe that we are worthy of love and belonging. But before we talk more about numbing and disconnection, I want to share two definitions with you. I shared my definition of love earlier. Here are the definitions of connection and belonging that emerge from the data. Connection. Connection is the energy that is created between people when they feel seen, heard, and valued, when they can give and receive without judgment. Belonging is the innate human desire to be part of something larger than us. Because this yearning is so primal, we often try to acquire it by fitting in and by seeking approval, which are not only hollow substitutes for belonging, but often barriers to it. Because true belonging only happens when we present our authentic and perfect selves to the world, our sense of belonging can never be greater than our level of self-acceptance. These definitions are crucial to understanding how we become disconnected in our lives and how we change. Living a connected life ultimately is about setting boundaries, spending less time and energy hustling and winning over people who don't matter, and seeing the value of working on cultivating connection with family and close friends. Before I undertook this research, my question was, what's the quickest way to make these feelings go away? Today, my question is, what are these feelings and where do they come from? Invariably, the answers are that I'm not feeling connected enough to Steve or the kids. And that this comes from, you know, take your pick, not sleeping enough, not playing enough, working too much, or trying to run from vulnerability. What has changed for me is that I know now that I can address these answers. The care and feeding of our spirits. One final question remains, and I hear it a lot. People often ask, where is the line between pleasure or comfort and numbing? In response, author and personal growth teacher Jennifer Loudon has named our numbing devices shadow comforts. When we're anxious, disconnected, vulnerable, alone, and feeling helpless, the booze and food and work and endless hours online feel like comfort. But in reality, they're only casting their long shadows over our lives. In her book, The Life Organizer, Loudon writes, shadow comforts can take any form. It's not what you do, it's why you do it that makes the difference. You can eat a piece of chocolate as a holy wafer of sweetness, a real comfort. Or you can cram an entire chocolate bar into your mouth without even tasting it in a frantic attempt to soothe yourself. A shadow comfort. You can chat on message boards for half an hour and be energized by community and ready to go back to work. Or you can chat on message boards because you're avoiding talking to your partner about how angry he or she made you last night. I found that what emerged from the data was exactly what Loudon points out. It's not what you do, it's why you do it that makes the difference. The invitation is to think about the intention behind our choices and, if helpful, to discuss those issues with family, close friends, or a helping professional. There aren't any checklists or norms to help you identify shadow comforts or other destructive numbing behaviors. This requires self-examination and reflection. Additionally, I would recommend listening with great care if the people you love say that they're concerned about you engaging in these types of behaviors. But ultimately, these are questions that transcend what we know and how we feel. They're about our spirit. Are my choices comforting and nourishing my spirit? Or are they temporary reprieves from vulnerability and difficult emotions, ultimately diminishing my spirit? Are my choices leading to my wholeheartedness, or do they leave me feeling empty and searching? For me, sitting down to a wonderful meal is nourishment and pleasure. Eating while I'm standing, being in front of the refrigerator or inside the pantry, is always a red flag. Sitting down to watch one of my favorite shows on television is pleasure. Flipping through channels for an hour is numbing. As we think about nourishing or diminishing our spirit, we have to consider how our numbing behaviors affect the people around us, even strangers. About a decade ago, I wrote an op-ed about cell phones and disconnection for the Houston Chronicle after witnessing how our crazy, busy, anxiety-fueled lifestyles affect other people. Here it is. Last week, while I was trying to enjoy my manicure, I watched in horror as the two women across from me talked on their phones the entire time they were getting their nails done. They employed head nods, eyebrow raises, and finger pointing to instruct the manicurist on things like nail length and polish choices. I really couldn't believe it. I had my nails done by the same two women for 10 years. I know their names, you know, their real Vietnamese names, their children's names, and many of their stories. They know my name, my children's names, and many of my stories. When I finally made a comment about the women on their cell phones, they both quickly averted their eyes. Finally, in a whisper, the manicurist said, "They don't know. Most of them don't think of us as people." On the way home, I stopped at Barnes & Noble to pick up a magazine. The woman ahead of me in line bought two books, applied for a new reader card, and asked to get one book gift-wrapped without getting off her cell phone. She plowed through the entire exchange without making eye contact or directly speaking to the young woman working at the counter. She never acknowledged the presence of the human being across from her. After leaving Barnes & Noble, I went to a drive-through fast food restaurant to get a Diet Dr. Pepper. Right as I pulled up to the window, my cell phone rang. I wasn't quite sure, but I thought it might be Charlie's school calling, so I answered it. It wasn't the school. It was someone calling to confirm an appointment. I got off the phone as quickly as I could. In the short time it took me to say, "Yes, I'll be at my appointment," the woman in the window and I had finished our soda for money transaction. I apologized to her the second I got off the phone. I said, "I'm so sorry. The phone rang right when I was pulling up and I thought it was my son's school." I must have surprised her because she got huge tears in her eyes and said, "Thank you. Thank you so much. You have no idea how humiliating it is sometimes. They don't even see us." I don't know how it feels for her, but I do know how it feels to be an invisible member of the service industry. It can suck. I worked my way through undergrad and some of graduate school, waiting tables and bartending. I worked in a very nice restaurant that was close to campus and a hot spot for wealthy college kids and their parents. Parents who were visiting for the weekend and treating their kids and their kids' friends to dinner. I was in my late 20s and praying to finish my bachelor's degree before I hit 30. When the customers were kind and respectful, it was okay. But one waiter as object moment could tear me apart. Unfortunately, I see these moments happening all of the time now. I see adults who don't even look at waiters when they speak to them. I see parents who let their young children talk down to store clerks. I see people rage and scream at receptionists, then treat the bosses, doctors, and bankers with the utmost respect. And I see the insidious nature of race, class, and privilege playing out in one of the most historically damaging ways possible, the server-served relationship. Everyone wants to know why customer service has gone to hell in a handbasket. I want to know why customer behavior has gone to hell in a handbasket. When we treat people as objects, we dehumanize them. We do something really terrible to their souls and our own. Martin Buber, an Austrian-born philosopher, wrote about the differences between an I-it relationship and an I-you relationship. An I-it relationship is basically what we create when we are in transactions with people whom we treat like objects, people who are simply there to serve us or complete a task. I-you relationships are characterized by human connection and empathy. Buber wrote, "When two people relate to each other authentically and humanly, God is the electricity that surges between them." After spending a decade studying belonging, authenticity, and shame, I can say for certain that we are hardwired for connection, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. I'm not suggesting that we engage in a deep, meaningful relationship with the man who works at the cleaners or the woman who works at the drive-thru. But I am suggesting that we stop dehumanizing people and start looking them in the eye when we speak to them. If we don't have the energy or time to do that, we should stay at home. Now, let's visit the less frequented shelves in the armory. So far, we've cracked open the armory doors to throw some light on the common arsenal that pretty much everyone uses to keep themselves safe from vulnerability. Foreboding joy, perfectionism, and numbing have emerged as the three most universal methods of protection, what we call major categories of defense. In this last part of the chapter, I want to briefly explore the less frequented shelves in the armory, where a few more masks and pieces of armor are kept. Most of us are likely to identify with one or more of these protection mechanisms, or at the very least, we'll see slivers of ourselves reflected back from their polished surfaces in a way that cultivates some understanding. The first shield, Viking or victim. I recognized this piece of armor when a significant group of research participants indicated they had very little use for the concept of vulnerability. Their responses to the idea that vulnerability might have value ranged from dismissive and defensive to hostile. What emerged from these interviews and interactions was a lens on the world that essentially saw people divided into two groups, Vikings or victims. Unlike some participants who had intellectual or theoretical issues with the value of vulnerability, these folks shared the belief that everyone, without exception, belongs to one of two mutually exclusive groups. You're either a victim in life, a sucker or a loser who's always been taken advantage of and can't hold your own, or you're a Viking, someone who sees the threat of being victimized as a constant, so you stay in control, you dominate, you exert power over things, and you never show vulnerability. As I coded the data from these interviews, I kept thinking about the chapter in my dissertation on the French philosopher Jacques Derrida and binary opposition, the pairing of related terms that are opposite. While the respondents didn't use all the same examples, a strong pattern of paired opposites emerged in the language they used to describe their worldview. Winner or loser. Survive or die. Kill or be killed. Strong or weak. Leaders or followers. Success or failure. Crush or be crushed. And, in case those aren't clear enough examples, there's the life motto of a high-achieving, take-no-prisoners lawyer. He said, "The world is divided into assholes and suckers. It's that simple." The source of their Viking or victim worldview was not completely clear, but most attributed it to the values they had been taught growing up, the experience of surviving hardships, or their professional training. The majority of the participants who fell into the group holding this view were men, but there were also women. It makes sense that this is a somewhat gendered issue, as many men, even men who don't rely on this armor, talked about the win-lose, zero-sum power dynamic being taught and modeled as they grew up. And don't forget, winning, dominance, and power over women were part of the list of masculine norms that we discussed in Chapter 3. In addition to socialization and life experiences, many of these folks held jobs or worked in cultures that reinforced the victim or Viking mentality. We heard this from servicemen and women, veterans, corrections and law enforcement officers, and people working in high-performance, super-competitive cultures like law, technology, and finance. What I don't know is if these folks sought careers that leveraged their existing Viking or victim belief system, or if their work experiences shaped this win-or-lose take on life. My guess would be that a larger percentage of folks belong to the former group, but I don't have the data to do more than speculate. One issue that made these interviews some of the most difficult was the honesty with which people spoke about the struggles in their personal lives. Dealing with high-risk behaviors, divorces, disconnection, loneliness, addiction, anger, exhaustion. But rather than seeing these behaviors and negative outcomes as consequences of their Viking or victim worldview, they perceived them as evidence of the harsh win-or-lose nature of life. When I look at the statistics in more vulnerability intolerant, kind of victim or Viking professions, I see a dangerous pattern developing. And no place is this more evident than in the military. The statistics on post-traumatic stress-related suicides, violence, addiction, and risk-taking all point to this haunting truth.